What if I told you somebody went out to the plains of San Agustin and found some artifacts from perhaps a downed UFO? That's exactly where we're going to go tonight with our guest, Art Campbell. He's got a book out called Finding the UFO Crash at San Agustin. Art Campbell is chairman of NICAP in Kansas City. In 1994, Art set forth on a quest. With map in hand, he visited a UFO crash site on the plains of San Agustin. There, he found materials presumed to be from the wreckage of a UFO. He took them back and had them analyzed. Tonight, we are going to find out together what that testing revealed. I'd like to welcome Art to the show for the very first time. Art, thanks for joining us. Welcome to Night Fright.
Oh, good evening. I'm glad to be with you.
How are things today? You're in Kansas City, are you?
No, I'm in Medford, Oregon.
Okay.
I grew up around Kansas City and went to school there. I'll be there in a couple of weeks. There's a nice conference down there called the Paracom.
Okay, very good. Now listen, what in the heck possessed you to go out in the plains of San Agustin with a map in hand? How did you get
there? Well, I've been asking myself that, and my wife has for about 20 years now. And I had heard that there had been a UFO crash out there, and I'd been into UFOs since the late 50s, and then I took about 30 years out for a high school teaching career. So I got back into it about 1989 or so, and I asked Stan Friedman about, I said, I don't think I want to go to the Roswell thing, get through that all that hype. And he said, well, there's another one out here on the plain of San Augustine. That no one has looked into very, very, very well, but we all sort of know the rancher. And so, I called the rancher and he said, well, come on out. This was, April 1994. And if you can get here before we go out to work cattle, we'll have a cup of coffee and a map. So, we did that and he gave us a nice cup of coffee, actually two, and a map how to get down there. So it was all, not far. It was about 5 miles from his house, right off of the main highway. So it wasn't very difficult at all. So that's how we started the project. A lot of people knew that there had been a crash there or suspected it because a gentleman had come forward at the time was in 1990, had taken a whole lot of dignitaries out there in a helicopter. And they had stood on the site where he said this UFO came in, and he was a five-year-old boy at the time. So we talk about him in our book and what he's had to say, and then he's since not too involved with it, but that's kind of how we got started. And I went out down by myself in 1995, started finding things. And we made our last trip about 2012.
What are some of the things you found out there in the desert?
Oh, goodness. Some of your listeners want to check my UFO site. I'll be talking from the webpage. So I'm okay to mention the UFO site?
Sure, no problem at all.
Yeah. It's UFO Crash Book, one word, www.ufocrashbook.com. And you'll see some of the things we're talking about. Well, we started finding a little thing. We started finding things like a lot of foil, and we had never seen foil in that kind of a setting before. And so we picked up everything that looked a little different. And then I found what looked like a body organ, and we had it checked out, and no one knows what it is at all. And
can you describe what it looked like, the body organ?
Yeah, it's actually a artificial body organ, and definitely a scientific device made of three layers of polyethylene, very similar to Tupperware, but it had hardened in the sand where it was laying. And so I have it on the site, and I also have a chapter, two chapters regarding it and its analysis. And we never told anyone that we were UFO investigators. We just get our stuff out there, and sometimes you have to pay through the nose to get the analysis done, but then you know it's not tainted, and somebody who has an opinion, and we kind of go from there. But then we also found that a year or two later, a small, tiny shoe sole, and we have that. You can see that on the homepage of the website, at least at the bottom of the series of pictures, UFOCrashBook.com website. You can see a mock-up of the shoe, and the actual sole was compared to the 25-cent piece. So we knew by the time, first time we started finding things that didn't belong in on the range, the cattle range. And there is a little trash there that had washed down in an arroyo. But once we got it kind of sorted out, we found a lot of stuff kind of underneath that. And we understood that the Army had been in there and cleaned it up and had borrowed a county road grader in 1947 and filled in the trench that the UFO made. And that's how the rancher discovered the site, because he had sagebrush missing in a certain part of his where it was growing on both sides. And that's how we how he was able to identify the fact something happened. And people told him after the Roswell book came out in 1980 that they thought one had crashed out there, and the main fellow that found it was an engineer named Barney Barnett. He was a soil conservation engineer, very credible guy.
Let me just give this quote by Barney Barnett, folks, and this is from the book Finding the UFO Crash at San Agustin, and that's by our guest tonight, Art Campbell, www.nightfrightshow.com, www.nightfrightshow.com. Click on tonight's guest book cover. That'll take you right to a spot where you can order the book online from the comfort of your own home. Also, don't worry about the URL to his website. That'll be posted on the Night Fright Show website as well. Now, Barney Barnett, folks, this is his quote. Are you ready for this? The bodies were small. 3.5 to 2 to 4 feet. Gray in color, eyes oddly spaced. Let me say that again. The bodies were small. So, Art, that leads me to believe that he actually saw the bodies of grays.
Well, it was the first report of a civilian about the gray aliens. He made his report to his friends and relatives and people in 1947, but it wasn't published till the Roswell Incident book came out in 1980. So essentially Barney Barnett is the first one to see dead gray aliens. He said there were several of them, two or three outside the craft and one or so inside. He thought maybe there were a total of about four of them. And they're wearing the standard material. We even found gray material that was rubberized. Would be strange, and other things that, that they may have been wearing, but this shoe sole is 4 7/8 inches long and 1.25 inches wide at the narrow part of the instep, and that's four sizes smaller than they even measure in international shoe standards. It fits no known earth foot, and I had many podiatrists say, well, this sure wouldn't fit a five-toed foot. Well, I didn't tell him it was probably four toes, but in any case, that was the little shoe sole. We spent a whole chapter in the book on that shoe sole.
Did you find it just lying on the ground unobtrusively, or did you have to dig for it? What was the
We did some digging, but some of the stuff, we found maybe half of the material, including metal wreckage, at a different part where the UFO apparently skipped out. But this was laying on the ground. And I'd walked around it several times, and I thought, oh, it's just another child's shoe and so forth. And I got really, I thought our children were a little wider than that. And actually, they're about at least third again as wide on the front. And this is a very narrow sole. So I picked it up and had it analyzed in a McCrone Laboratories in Chicago. And all the layers, there were nine layers of fabric in the, nine layers of material in the sole. This wasn't a cheap old piece of shoe with a rubber sole. This thing had been well made. And, they came back and said that it, actually they had done some work on the Shroud of Turin for the Vatican. in the late 70s. So they were very well known, very respected.
What was
they had no idea what it was.
Analysis of that art? What was their final analysis of that art?
Well, I told them that I had found it in the desert. I didn't dare say it was a UFO thing, but they charged me so much money to get it looked at, and I gave it to them. And they said that we've never seen anything like this in the way of a shoe, of a footwear. And we have examined other footwear. They are specialists in fabrics. And we believe the shoe was fabric covered because we found underneath the sole between two layers some actual fabric sticking out. And anybody who wants to take a look at that, who is on the website, there's a chapter 13 down there that deals with the shoe sole. And there's a little bit of a montage there about what we found. And they could actually see this fabric sticking out of the bottom of the shoe sole between two layers. And guess what the color was of the shoe? Red. Red or maroon.
Wow. That's explosive. I think we have William on the line. William, do you have a question? Bill? Are you there, my friend?
Yep, I am. Thank you, Brent, for taking my call. First off, just a shout-out to Connie and Dave Davidson. I think they're listening to your show for the first time from Newport Beach.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much, guys.
Yeah, so fight on. Mr. Campbell, first off, pleasure to meet you. Second of all, I had emailed you about a month ago. I had indicated my wife and I were going to Roswell and wanted to take a few photographs of the area, and you were kind enough to email back. I want to thank you very much for that.
Yes, I remember that.
Yes, thank you for taking the time. A lot of people wouldn't, but I appreciated it very much, and we're looking forward to taking that trip to Horse Springs. I've got a number of questions to ask you, but this is Brent's show, and I'll jump in from time to time.
Fire away, Bill. You're always welcome on this show.
Number one, you know, there are a number of ranches out there in that area, as you well know. Were there any of the generations past that came forward during that period of time that you know of that verified that they had heard, they had seen, or they were aware of this crash in that area, because it did happen so close to the Horse Springs area. Of course, that's not a big town, so there may not have been much there, you know, in 47. But did any of the families come forward to report something like this?
Actually, no. There were people do remember the military being around there, but they were I've been around there during the war. And there was a plane crash in 1944 up at a place called New Horse Springs. And they were there photographing wreckage and what have you. So people were quite used to the military, although there weren't a lot of them around. But the small areas, you know, they say, well, sometimes a volcano can blow it. If you're in a valley away, you won't hear it. And I think this was kind of what happened there. People were living a little higher ground, and this was a low ground, and sounds tend to travel up, and we think probably the craft came in at some time on the night of July 2nd, 1947, maybe the 1st or the 2nd, somewhere midnight or somewhere in that area, and it didn't explode, it scraped in. So it wouldn't have been a noise that somebody, you know, in a house with a fan or whatever going on would have heard. And there was one man that was hired to pick up some missile wreckage. And we suspect very strongly that they had, once they got the craft out after about a day or so, that they got some of the local people to help them pick up the wreckage. And we traced this man, his wife, down. He's gone now, but she was living down in Gravette, Arkansas. And she said, yes, he said about July 1947 that he'd been asked by the military to help pick up a wreckage. Well, these Western-type people are very high with integrity. And if they are told not to say anything, they don't say anything. And they would just as soon go get on with it. Their lives were important to build around their cattle and the seasons, and they've got their hands full. So there's quite a few ranchers there, but a lot of land is owned by absentee owners, and then that's leased back to the ranchers who are there for grazing cattle.
I was interested in the story, which kind of, you know, verifies that things occurred out there with regards to the, and I don't think you've spoken about it yet, but the lieutenant, I think his name was Lieutenant Reed, who became a colonel, who was working at the Pentagon.
Yes.
And his senior advisor had said to him, well, if you want to know anything about UFOs, you should head out and talk to Barney about it. He's actually touched one or something to that effect.
We had him verify that conversation.
Yeah, I thought you might like to. I don't know if Brent knows about this, but maybe you can talk about that.
No, that's great, Bill. I you know, you just keep asking your questions because I just keep crossing off like this, my friend. So that's
William Wade.
But you go ahead. Could you tell the folks that story? I was going to ask you about the Pentagon revelations.
William Wade was a junior officer who just had graduated from St. Lawrence University, an ROTC program, and he was commissioned as second lieutenant in the Army Reserves in early 1960. And one of the jobs he had was in Washington, D.C., as a young lieutenant, and was declassifying papers. Incidentally, nothing to do with UFOs, just declassifying papers as some office work. And he was having coffee one day, and the coffee room, and had mentioned the fact that he had some interest in it. And a colonel was over there reading a newspaper. He said he put his paper down, looked at him, and said, "You really want to see somebody, want to meet somebody who saw a UFO? You need to go down and talk to Barney Barnett in Socorro, New Mexico. He touched one." Well, Lee remembered this for years, and finally after a hitch in Korea, he came back around Fort Bliss, and Fort Bliss is just due east of Roswell, and we're 165 miles west of the Roswell area, so kind of in that part of the country, west central New Mexico. And so he drove over to Socorro, and he was afraid if he called Barnett on the phone, who was still living then. He had 2 years to live. He died in 69. And he called him on the phone. He didn't call him on the phone. He went over there, and he said a very polite man answered the door and identified himself as Barney Barnett. And he identified himself as somebody interested in the UFO crash. And Barnett had been bothered by some military people, and I think he didn't want to turn one away. He didn't exactly know what the guy wanted, and he didn't know he was freelancing on his own. And he said he was only there about 15 minutes because he started feeling very uncomfortable. Digging into one of the nature's top secrets, and he was trying to work his way up in the military as a young lieutenant at the time. But he came back and told his story. By the way, it had a Canadian base. Stanton Freeman was on a radio show with one of his co-authors for his new book, Crash of Corona. And William Lee called in to Friedman in Toronto. And that's how William Lee got involved in the thing. And he's the only witness we have that's from the military that's independent of all the people who live anywhere near Barnett. The rest of them are all knew him or knew of him, or his boss even was involved. So he had a kind of a civilian boss that worked with the soil conservation agents in those years. So he said he had confirmed that that there was a crash and he had touched it. And he didn't say whether it was hot, cool, or tepid, but he said, but Lee forgot to ask if there were any occupants. He said, to this day, I regret not asking about and he kind of left in a hurry because he felt uncomfortable, and I think.
Well, you know, I think I think that one of the keys to that is that you've got a colonel in the Pentagon that knows who Barney Barnett is. I mean, how in the heck would he know who he is if the Army didn't know that this actually took place? I mean, that kind of was a smoking gun for me when I read through all this.
I made that point in the book. He's a completely corroborating witness from an independent source, and it just don't get any better than that. A colonel of high stature, and he was a colonel when he retired, then he called into around 1979 or so at a Toronto radio station. And, no, he's a very credible man, and he's still alive.
www.nightfrightshow.com, folks. The name of the book we're discussing tonight is Finding the UFO Crash at San Agustin, and that's in New Mexico. Our guest tonight is Art Campbell. He has taken some artifacts from that area and had them analyzed. And Art, I was going to ask you some more. Were they all basically the same type of metallic configuration, or were there distinctive unsimilarities between the two of the artifacts?
Earlier, we've taken some fabric, taken some shoe sole material, we've taken some other stuff, but the main thing we found was metal. And metal can be analyzed in a lab because it has isotopes in it. And we know what kind of how many isotopes are in iron found on Earth, or chromium or whatever we're dealing with. And with modern processes, there's one called ICP-MS, which is very complicated, but they pulverize and then run it up into a
Oh, could you just repeat?
Tell me what kind of metal you have coming out.
He's trying to call you there, Art, and you keep cutting out on us. Can you just repeat what you just said?
What kind of metals has come out, and that's what the ICP does.
Okay, and what was the makeup? Did it seem familiar to you in its makeup, the metallurgy?
Oh my goodness, it had exotic things in it. We had high degree of silicon, magnesium. We have a report. Hang it up, please. We have a report on 15 different types of metal. Some of it came off the bottom of the craft. Some of it was involved in a propulsion system between the two layers of the bottom and the interior, the next interior piece. About an inch and a half long. It looks like a honeycomb, wasp nest. We found, a couple square feet of that later on. After 2011, we started going up on the side of the hill with metal detectors. So every piece of metal we have in there, it has been written up, and what the high concentrations are of the components of the metal are also in the book. Then there's another report that's free. If you get to the website, there's one that says Metal Analysis Coburn. And he was hired by a gentleman named John Rao to do an analysis of the metal those 10 pieces of foil we found, six pieces, I think it was. So that's very detailed. It's a 42-page report on 6 pieces of foil. And they really did a fine job of analyzing it. And as far as we can tell, we did not have any kind of metallurgy of this type in 1947.
Was there anything that stood out, one piece against the others, perhaps something that was not identifiable?
Hardly any of it we had was not identifiable. We couldn't identify anything with anything we knew. So we found other pieces. I told you some of the trash the locals had thrown into the Royal. They don't people in those days didn't take their trash out, but they just put it in the Royal and flash flood. Voila, it's all gone. You know, and some of it washed down to where we were working, but we found old concentrations of things that we hadn't seen in years on top of the surface. It should have been a foot down, and which told us that the soil had been churned, over. We think that was done when they were filling in the trench, maybe about 100 feet long.
Is there any legacy of what happened to the crash that crashed there, other than the pieces that you found? Does anybody, is there any farmers or any witnesses around that say, yeah, we moved this to a certain area? Anything along those lines?
The local people are not interested in UFOs. They have their cattle, they have their schedules. They have to get move the cattle to pasture, or they have to take it to market or something like that. And they are mildly interested, but they're not going to go out on the limb to get a dither over it. And we found them quite blasé. Even if we held stuff in their hand, they said, oh, that's interesting. It showed a natural interest, but not one where they would take a lot of time to study it. So we didn't have a local interest of people, and it made it easy to get in places because we kept our word. We just locked the gates and did all the things that that they asked you to do. And we were able to come in and out of there for 20 years and still have good relations with the rancher. So they were interested in what we saw and what we found, and they realized it. We would like to take it and analyze it, and they were very nice about it all.
Where are the artifacts now, Art?
Well, some of them are – we have them dispersed not deliberately, but it turns out we have about six countries, a couple, three are in Canada. And we have some as far away as Hong Kong. People started getting pieces of stuff from us and getting done with their own analysis. We would not give it to people unless they had some kind of connected with some kind of a laboratory. And incidentally, a lot of the people who said they were connected with laboratories weren't, though we ended up losing some of it. But we had enough to fill the bottom of a wheelbarrow, and so we can spare a one-inch piece here and there. So quite a bit of it is kept in New Mexico. I have the everything up to 2005 of the shoe sole, the artifact, which we think may have been artificial, an artificial body part, possibly from a clone, an artificially made alien. They made apparently made clones of themselves and then added artificial parts to help them in the rigors of space. And I have some of the foil and like I say, the shoe sole and other things. And the big metal, a friend of mine kept down north of the plains up in the Gallup area. And he produced those two expeditions. We've had about 26 people in all who have been working with us, including a crew of Navajos in about 2004 and 5.
Is there any oral legends that are passed down through the Navajos from generation to generation? You know, we always hear of sky people, and certainly the Aboriginal folks here in Canada have such stories. I was just wondering if they related any of those stories to you.
No, I wasn't close to them. They were my friend had been a builder, and it was kind of slack time in the mid right after prior to 2006 and 7 in there. And a lot of people were out of work, you recall. This down here, in lower 48. And, he had had these guys working for him on various jobs, so he'd hired them to come down and do some excavation. And he'd built, four or five big screens. There, you can see that some of them in the homepage if you, go to the, what we have in the, our homepage. And they collapsed and went into a van. And so we did 28 test holes, 28 holes in 2004, and found about six more pieces of the foil.
Wow.
And so and that's also when we found the fabric and other things. And then it wasn't until 2011 we started working on a hillside. We found out the UFO had skipped up there. That's where we found the big stuff. Some of that stuff is 20 inches long and 6 inches, 8 inches wide. Big shards of stuff.
Would you like to go back and do it again? and see what else you could find by digging deeper, perhaps, using stronger metal detectors, that type of thing, gridded out?
Well, I'm 82 now, and I don't know how many more times I'm going back there, but I have some fond memories. I would go if I could ride some kind of a Bronco or a vehicle or something. I'm kind of my knees are kind of bunged up, and the doctor said I should be walking on unlevel ground. And so I think we'll hang it up and just go with the book now. It took us 20 years to put it together.
I understand. You know, you mentioned the foil, and for years I've been hearing that when crunched up, the foil just resumes its original position. Did you have an experience like that with the foils that you found?
The foil we found, it was a different thicknesses, and it is analyzed in that report called Metal Analysis Coburn off of a blue button on a web page. And we haven't the slightest idea what it was for. But each one is different. We found about 15 different pieces, and one or two are duplicates of, a torn piece of another one. But each has anywhere from 35 to 40 elements on a coating on one side. And primarily it's aluminum with a coating. And we think it blew out of a gap in the UFO when it hit down. And we think it split open or had split, and it split open a little further. And when that happens, you have a decompression. And we've all seen how decompression works in an airplane. Well, I'm sure it was fairly similar to inside the UFO when it split open. Anything that was loose and in the walls or whatever would probably may have come out. We think that foil was probably in the the layers of the wall. And the walls of the craft, which were all, we think, at least about 3 inches thick. And some of that may have been insulation. We don't know. We just absolutely have no idea what the foil is for.
Any evidence of any anomalies, like any fire, any tearing, like were the edges straight? Were they torn? Like, I'm thinking of an airplane crash, not referencing the crash that had taken place there earlier. But, when flying crafts of any kind are going to crash, there's going to be some trauma to the metal. Is there anything of that indicated?
Well, we found some of it appeared to be burnt, but it was, since it was layered, it could be sunburned. It could be laying out there for 50 years, and it could be dark. Some of the way it was darker than others. The artifact that we had, the doctors that looked at it, medical people, said that it appeared to have been in an explosion, and that it had apparently blown out of the craft. Whether it was attached to somebody, I don't know. We think that the craft had a mishap, maybe 300 miles north, and it brought in some stuff, some pine needles and stuff that we discovered that the pine trees weren't growing down there. And so, certain kind of moss doesn't grow in New Mexico, yet there was moss on this honeycomb material, and we think it may have had a mishap as far out as 300 or 400 miles and just made it to the plains because it was relatively flat. And if they had gotten over this little rise of rocks, it would have been flat for miles. But they went down the Royal and bounced in, and didn't have enough power apparently to get out to the flat area.
Folks, if you're just joining us, you're probably glued to your seat as I am. Finding the UFO crash at San Agustin, and we're looking at some artifacts tonight that were found by our guest and author of the book, Art Campbell. Easy way to get his book, folks, as always, with any of our guests on the show, www.nightfrightshow.com, www.nightfrightshow.com. Click on tonight's guest book cover, and that'll take you right to his space, where you can buy it from the comfort of your own home. I was going to ask you too, Art, with all this, have you approached mainstream with your findings, mainstream media, and what have they said?
Well, I have some funny things that they said. Don't play careful. I took it to a newspaper not far away here, down in a town called Grants Pass, Oregon, so you may know it. And the guy says, "Well, this is interesting," but he says, "Have you taken it to a college?" I thought, oh boy, you know, here goes a Condon report again. They tried to, you know, it was the college people were the ones that started the cover up. But they took the Roswell records. And, I haven't had, any, exciting, bits of interest from the mainstream media. And I am, not in this for the media. If they want to contact me, I'll be glad to talk to anybody. Meet them if they're going to come through and show them some of the material we have. They don't seem to be, believe that you have anything, or that if you do, I don't think they want to get involved in the controversy. And you would think the biggest story ever told, well, not the biggest one, but one of them, would interest them. Well, they get so many people coming in that are phony and have some something that they're pushing, and so some cause and some conspiracy and so forth and so on. And that's even made people pull away even further from the mainstream UFO thing. So we decided to put a book out, and it's got very, very good reviews. I looked at the last time I looked at the reviews on the website. You can order the book, by the way, off the website. It's all the reviews are 5-star reviews.
Congratulations. That's great news. Art, you have something on your website called How Does Anti-Gravity Work? Could we go there now?
Sure. That's, we found the pieces of it. And it would be like somebody handing you a bag of flour, some chocolate chips, some baking soda, some sugar, and say, now make a cookie. If you didn't have the recipe, you know, when you were 10 or 12 years old. So we found the pieces and had to put them together to make it realize that it had scraped off the bottom of the UFO. And we found the exterior piece, which was extremely tough. And then we found the next piece inside, which was a lighter material. But we found on the inside of both of these pieces of metal some brown dots about 1/8 inch across. And when the honeycombs touched the metal, there was some kind of fusion there, some kind of metal fusion, that inside each honeycomb piece was a brown dot. And from the brown dots, when energy was directed towards the metal they were hooked to, they were actually a part of the metal itself, it produced an anti-gravity apparently in the honeycomb. And we think this honeycomb extended the entire bottom of the craft, maybe 25 feet. And we got well over every square foot of it. And we don't know, we suspect that this is part of the anti-gravity, and we don't know what propelled the craft. But my guess is that what we found was at least what would make the craft float on magnetic waves. And how it, you know, pushed itself so fast, though, we don't know. All kinds of theories out there. And one of the more interesting theorists was Bob Lazar, who had been worked very briefly at S4 out of the Vegas area. And he didn't keep his job very long, had a falling out with his superior. So he kind of went public and talked about some of the things. And he said he looked up inside the craft and saw the little furniture. That always kind of got to me. And he was hired to help get into a nuclear reactor, which apparently is in the center, maybe the size of a basketball. And we have some reactors that are that size. But it may be that what distributes how they get their energy. But we know that the part of the anti-gravity system was in between the outer piece of metal and an inner piece of metal and what looks like a big wasp nest. And it would be a wasp nest 25 feet across. And in each wasp nest would be a brown dot at the top piece of metal, a brown dot on the bottom with the bottom piece of metal. And it was a fairy firing some kind of energy back and forth. And it also traveled, on the upper plate and the lower plate. So we think that it was about a band of energy of whatever type of energy, maybe 1.5 inches, 2 inches thick, across the top of the bottom of the UFO. We found some upper pieces that apparently didn't have these dots, so we assumed it wasn't using it was using some other form of energy. But these are the dots where we finally got, they figured out the recipe, and we're sure that it's significant.
Just speculation on my part, Art, but do you think the samples that you found, the various metallic samples, do you think that they could have shown up on radar? Did they have reflected radar?
I'm not familiar with radar in the 40s. There was a theory that one of the reasons that they crashed was that they were ran afoul of our own radar, and then Doppler radar was mentioned as a possibility, and we use that now for weather forecasting. And I find it difficult to think that somebody who's maybe 500-600 years ahead of us, if not more, couldn't find a way around our radar. They can make themselves invisible with certain magnetic things. So, and we have planes that are very hard to pick up on radar now. So I don't think that our radar would have had a great deal of imprint on their visiting our planet.
Bill has a question for you again. Bill from Nevada. How you doing, buddy?
I'm all right. I'm enjoying this very much. Hey, Art, in regards to Barney Barnett's memoirs about this, did he ever indicate how long he was there on the site before the Army pulled up?
No, less than an hour. We were able to gather that from, but there was another civilian, group of civilians there, and a group of archaeologists came over from across the plains. They'd seen the thing come down the night before. They thought it was a meteor. And, they all kind of converged there within an hour, and my guess is he probably found a craft about maybe about 10:30, quarter to 11, and, some other people kind of drifted in. You could see the aluminum, glinting from the highway. That's how he happened to see it. He was traveling south and on Highway 12 up there. And he knew the farmers and what they were building because of his work with the soil conservation thing. So he didn't know of any buildings out there that had a shiny roof. And the first thing of people up there was thinking, well, there's a plane crash. Maybe I ought to go over and help. Well, he got over there and he said that he kind of stuck up on it. But he actually told people about this, but he didn't write anything down. He was in his first year with the Soil Conservation Service after having been with them for 10 years, and this was his retirement job. He was there another 10 years. And in those years, people just didn't accept everything that this conservation person had. It was inconvenient to them, and particularly didn't want to overgraze the land and things like that. And they had to kind of work their way into the thinking of the people there, the conservation. And so we think that he probably didn't want to come out and say anything. If we think he was asked not to by the military. And I'm sure he was asked not to by his boss, who didn't want to turn everybody off to their new conservation guy. So he told his niece and other people, I think called them Dalhart, Texas, about it. And the wife talked about it for years, but they didn't write anything. And she kept a diary. It actually was not a dear diary kind of thing. She was in social activities during 1947. And so she has him going up to the part of the plains they call the high country. And whenever they talked about going up to the plains, they use the word high country. She has him leaving there on the morning of about 8 o'clock on the morning of July 2nd when he discovered the craft. Didn't write anything, but he talked about it to a few people.
Well, you know, it would seem to me, and I don't, you know, I know a little bit about that area. I don't know where the nearest Army base would have been, but it would seem to me that that it would have had to been picked up on radar by someone, because you're just not going to have the Army show out of nowhere if it hadn't been picked up by radar, because, you know, we're talking about 1947. There's not a lot of communication going on out there in the middle of New Mexico, especially in that area.
I agree with you. Probably that's how the military got there. There were no bases nearby. The nearest base was about a five-hour drive to up at Albuquerque. And then south was the White Sands Missile Range. And in those days, Von Braun and his crew from Germany were down there working in their Fort Bliss, down that area, not Fort Bliss, on the Mexican line down there, it's the name of the fort. And they were stationed down there, and then we had Holloman Air Force Base, which became Holloman in 1948. And they trained bombers there during the war. So my guess is that they had picked it up, because it was a wounded craft, apparently, coming in. It wasn't; it couldn't be very stealthy, but that 300-mile crash path, you know. And my guess is that they had a crew set up, and they were managed to be in telephone contact with them when they stopped them to call back. And they said, well, we're pretty sure we know where it is. They had a spotter plane out, so they got daylight. My guess is they found the crash through using their radar path and the spotter plane, and then they had a crew already heading that direction. So there's still gravel roads in those days, so it would take them 4 or 5 hours to get there.
Yeah. You know, one of the interesting parts of this story, you just talked about the archaeologist that came over the hill, the professor that was from Harvard with the four students. You might want to mention I don't know who found the research, but the letter that was written by this particular professor that put him out there in that area that they found in the archives.
Is it Dr. Herbert Dick, Bill?
Yes.
Yeah, was Herbert Dick. You got it right. Dick was a graduate student who had come up from the University of New Mexico. So he was familiar with the land down there, particularly the archaeology. And he wanted to work a site for his thesis, for his doctor's thesis. And there was another guy from the University of Chicago who wanted the same site. And so they got into kind of a conflict over it.
That was
and,
right.
Yeah, that would be William Hurt. He was the other graduate student. And so we think they asked him to put down everything he knew about when he went down there and everything, so they would have it on record and send it in to his advisor. Well, he sent an 8-page letter written on December 14th to his advisor talking about this and other things, but not the crash. He never admitted to being at the crash, and he didn't want to tell them it either. But he did make camp on the 1st of July, 1947. And everybody who contacted him, they said, oh, we weren't there in 1947. We weren't there. We weren't there. Well, in his own writing, it was signed by himself as a letter to his advisor. We made camp at the Bat Cave on the 1st of July, 1947. Now, I don't imagine that they're not the first people who have told an untruth to UFO investigators. But he had more at stake than we would think, because he's not going to get a PhD from Harvard saying he'd found a UFO crash. And people didn't think you're alive on the planet those days. Some of them didn't.
Yeah, I was going to say there's nothing worse than coming out and saying that you have a belief in UFOs and perhaps some evidence to kill a career any quicker. I can't think of anything that would kill a career.
It'd be a career crusher, that's for sure.
Holy cow, would it ever. Folks, fantastic show tonight. Got a great guest, Art Campbell's here. Finding the UFO Crash in San Augustine. We're talking about artifacts that he's found and older, I guess you could say from the 40s, older archaeologist digs and things of that. Something went on there, folks. There's no question. Something crashed there, and we're still trying to figure that out. I had mentioned before one of the witnesses there, Barney Barnett, had said the bodies were small, 3.5 to 4 feet, gray in color, eyes oddly spaced. Now, if that doesn't resemble a gray that we've come to know as a gray, I don't know what does. Now, you put into the whole mix the fact that Art has found a small insert from a boot that would probably be perfect fit to a small body like that with small, tiny feet. There's something going on there. You know, I always revert back to the old saying, where there's smoke, there is fire. www.nightfrightshow.com, www.nightfrightshow.com. Click on tonight's guest book cover and order the book. We're coming up to break in 6 minutes, Art, and just hang around when that happens. I just want to thank Kelly Logue. Kelly Logue, folks, puts this whole show together for us on the Night Fright website. He does superhuman work. He's amazing. Kelly lives up in Alaska, Juneau, Alaska, and he does all this for us week in, week out. Kelly, from the bottom of my heart, as always, thank you so very, very much for helping us out. Art, let's go back a little bit now. Now, in your speculation, because, you know, you're an ICAP guy from Kansas, in your speculation and people you've spoke to, what are their and your, I guess I'm looking for something in terms of validation. What are your speculations about the artifacts you found? Do you feel that they are extraterrestrial, that they're, or that there might be something more earthly to them?
Well, the material we sent in was all of it, and you can read that report, the Coburn Science Report, click on the first page there of the website. And it's, by the way, it's 42 pages, and it's downloadable. Anybody wants it can have it. And a lot of it's in color. We shouldn't have ink in your printer. In any case, we didn't send anything. I'm a Western historian. I have four of the books about Western history. And so one of the things the ways I learned about Western history is to look at the trash dumps. And you could find out about the time of a certain time of year. You'd have a certain time of the century. You'd have certain kinds of China. You'd have the real find, of course, the license plate. We didn't get any license plate off the UFO, though, but we know it was 47. And so I've had an idea of what was thrown away by people here on Earth and what wasn't. And the material we started finding there, some of the material we started finding there, was nothing we'd seen anything like it. And we really didn't get into the project real deeply until 2011 when we went up on a hillside. And somebody who'd seen something up there went up there. And we found pieces up there that would cover half of a wheelbarrow. And it was everything was sent in, and we sent in one-inch size pieces to different labs. So we have about, my guess is, 22 items that have gone to labs, and all 22 of them were not part of our metallurgy in 1947. I'd love to find, UFOs and material, but we had to prove it to the lab. If you write the book about it, you need to have expert opinions.
Absolutely, yeah. It seems that you have that as well. So there's something that's not quite right in this whole puzzle that leads to you believe that we're extraterrestrials. And, what does Stanton Friedman have to say? Has he ever seen the artifacts or held the artifacts?
Oh, yes, he has. Stanton was the one who told me about the rancher. Stanton was there in 1990 with his five-year-old pointing out where the crash path. It's for your readers who have UFO books. It's in the Crash at Corona, page 70. And there's Stanton standing there with a fellow named John Carpenter from Springfield, Missouri, the kid that was 5 years old, and Gerald Anderson. And a fellow named Bigelow, who'd pay for the thing out of, who's a realtor over in real estate over in the Vegas area. And, therefore, I'm standing there in the middle of that book, pointing, at the direction where this, craft came in. And so, he had, talked to the rancher, and I told him I didn't think he'd want to visit, Roswell site. We had to spend another day in Roswell, which wasn't a bad place, but we wanted to get on to, towards Oregon, was our home, and that was on our way, so we said, let's go over there and look at that place, and that was a fateful decision. Cost a lot of money the last 20 years going back down there for a round trip of 2,600 miles.
Wow. Hang on to that for a second. Folks, we're coming up to the break. I'm Brent Holland from Night Fright, www.nightfrightshow.com. Click on tonight's guest book cover. That'll take you right to a spot where you can get the book, which is called Finding the UFO Crash at St. Augustine, and also the URL for Art Campbell, who's our guest tonight. There's the music. His site be there as well. Stick around 6 minutes, folks. We'll be right back. I'm going to ask Art about President Eisenhower perhaps meeting with aliens. You heard me right. We're going to discuss that in the next hour, as well as the new Dominican artifact. Art, just stick around for 6 minutes. Thank you. I'll be right back.
I'll do it. I'm not sure.
Welcome back, folks. Welcome back to Night Fright. I'm your host, Brent Holland. Tonight, an explosive show, Finding the UFO Crash at San Augustine. It's my little French-Canadian accent working its way in there growing up in Montreal. Don't hold it against me. It doesn't make me a bad person. It just makes me a Habs fan. Art Campbell is chairman of NICAP Kansas City. In 1994, folks, Art set forth on a quest. With map in hand, he visited a UFO crash site. That's right, UFO crash site on the plains of San Augustine. There he found materials presumed to be from the wreckage of a UFO. Now, he's had them tested, and there was no metal that was comparable in those days that were part of the artifacts that he found. And that, my friends, is explosive. Art, welcome back. Thanks for sticking around, everybody. And www.nightfrightshow.com. Just click on tonight's guest book cover. We'll take you right to a spot where you can order the book. Oh, and I can't forget this, or my publisher will kill me. I am not good at this, folks, so bear with me for 5 seconds. I have a book out. The book is released. It is on Amazon.com. It is called The JFK Assassination from the Oval Office to Dealey Plaza, interviews with witnesses and specialists, including the last interview with Ted Sorensen, JFK's friend and speechwriter. I had spent an afternoon with Ted in his Manhattan apartment, and I had videotaped it as well, and I'm turning that into a documentary, as it turned out to be his last interview. You're going to find some explosive revelations in there as well, folks. Ted Sorensen, what he had to say about the assassination is going to blow mainstream media out of its mind, because you're going to get confirmation. You can go to Amazon.com or www.nightfrightshow.com and order your copy of the book right now. There we go. That's over with. I hate self-promotion. Let's go back to Art. Art? Welcome back.
Yes.
Great. Finding the UFO Crash at St. Augustine. What other things that are in the book that people are going to be really gravitating towards? What other things make up the content of the book?
Well, we go through about 15 different chapters, and I'm going to take the liberty of going through the table of contents, the books in front of me, if I won't be forgetting anything. But we start in with some of the early days when we were at the site, and we were just finding a smaller material down in the lower area. Then we eventually moved up to the upper part of the area where we found the big stuff. Apparently the craft had skipped at least once before it plopped down in a royal and then went about 100 feet and made a trench. So some of the other things that you would find in there, we've had a small section on fabric we found, had it also analyzed by Crone Associates. We talked, of course, about the shoe sole. Then we do a chapter on the 211 dig, which was our big one. That's where we've had about 25 or 30 pounds of metal. And that's when we found the first piece of honeycomb, by the way. And eventually it... The honeycomb would be filled in with rocks with the rain and the dirt, and the Army put, I think, a thin layer of dirt over everything, and then didn't know it was 14 inches of rain. sound like an Army operation, doesn't it? And after a few years, I think some of the stuff was laying on the surface, but the rocks, the honeycombs were filled with mud and dirt, and you couldn't tell they were honeycombs until somebody kicked one, and it went ping. And we realized that some of the rocks we thought we were looking at were some of this honeycomb material. And you could run an ice pick all the way through it, an inch and a half. It broke out the dirt and so forth. We found one in a mouse nest. We think that somebody who'd been in the cleanup crew decided to stash it behind some rocks down there where the craft ended up. And it was the first one we found in May, I think, of 2011, a piece about 5 by 7 inches, something like that, inch and a half thick.
Wow, that's big. That's ridiculous.
And that we have quite a bit more of that. We found up higher. Then we go into the archaeologist. We go into some of the early inhabitants of the plains. We get into archaeology here and why they were out there. Something about the Chiricahua Indians, who, by the way, were forerunners of the area Apaches. Apaches were kind of a later amalgamation of the Indian tribes. And whenever we're speculating, we let it be known that that's what we're doing. And we don't say this is the way it was and try to make it, we know the answers or anything like that. But we've got through on a lot of questions. And we still have some unanswered. But
what are those questions that you don't have answered?
Oh, goodness. Is there another skip site? If it was dropping debris a quarter mile away, was it dropping debris further than that way? There's a road involved, and we haven't ever gone across the road yet. My guess is that we found a honeycomb, and one of the things you asked me about was that we found was an I-beam. Now, this is what Jesse Marcel found over in Roswell. Right. Our I-beam is 13 and a quarter inches long, 2 inches wide on the flanges, and the centerpiece of the I-beam is about an inch and a quarter. A huge thing.
Was the writing on yours as well? Because Jesse Marcel has writing on it.
We had stone writing on ours, too.
Really?
Yes.
Holy cow.
It wasn't writing. I'm afraid nobody sending us a message. It was a triangle and a circle. Took off one flange of the I-beam, and it was about 2 inches, 2.5 inches high. The circle was about a half inch right in the center. So we went to photograph it at a friend's house down in New Mexico. And I bought some graphite. You know, you buy a locksmith, black graphite?
Sure, sure.
And they used to lubricate rocks with, locks with, sorry. And I rubbed it on there so the impressions would show up better. You know, they're darker. Well, when I got home and looked at my digital film, I found some concentric circles behind the triangle lined up with the circles in the triangle. And doing some research, I discovered that it looked to me like it was an eclipse with the last circle ending up in the triangle. And it had a kind of a wavy path. It reminded me very much of some crop circles I've seen. And they call it a planet path. So some of the crop circles show planet paths, how certain planets go through whatever area they're located. And so we compared this with the Jim Peniston triangle and a couple of circles. He's the guy from Bentwaters and Woodbridge-Bentwaters Air Base there in England. Famous sighting, sighting there of a unmanned drone. We think it was an unmanned craft. And he had a triangle on there and a circle, a couple of circles. Well, we looked at his logo, and apparently his circle is a planet circling around the sun in a triangle. So the two things here that these things have in common Both of them found 33 years apart, but ours was 47, his was 1980-something, was that apparently the aliens have a reverence for celestial events. Well, now, that's not surprising. We all do. So this may be part of their religious expression, is to make symbols and logos dealing with celestial events. That's just a theory.
No, it sounds as good a theory as anybody I've ever had put forward one, and it seems plausible. Bill from Nevada has a question for us. Bill?
Hi, Art. Hey, you know, a lot of people who have done research on UFO crashes or have done research of any type of ufology that have gotten too close to the truth end up sometimes being visited by the men in black. And a lot of people think that this is just a bunch of hocus-pocus stuff, but this stuff actually happens. My question is, have you ever been contacted by anyone from the government or something along those lines telling you to keep your mouth shut?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I was sitting by my front window one day when we had our computer in the front window, and a black van pulls up outside, and two guys get out in dark suits, and young guys, and one carried a big black briefcase, and I thought, oh, boy. And I had contacted my lawyer, and she had given me a card. She said, if any government people contact you, you hand them my card and say that you have retained me, and they can't contact you. They can't come in, and they can't question you. So some of your listeners out there may want to know this. So I was all ready to go to the door and reach for the card, and it was two Mormon missionaries. And in the black case with the Bible, I've never been so glad to see missionaries at my door in my life.
What a great story. What a great story, Art. You had me on the edge of my seat. I was thinking they were going to pull a machine gun out or something.
Well, I was expecting everything from handcuffs. I don't know what I was expecting to find in that briefcase. But, well, I advise Amanda, whatever you're drinking, I'm pouring. Now, they both had a glass of water. But, it was funny. I haven't had a whisper from anybody that has claimed to be from the government. And I'm thinking I'm getting some interest in libraries from my book, and I found out that a librarian at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, is interested in taking my book to a conference where there's all kinds of other military librarians. By the way, they're civilians. And that if they think it may be getting some orders as a result of that, that they think that it's good enough to for people to read in the military libraries. And he said, I may even get a contact with somebody in the library at the Pentagon. I said, well, that's gonna blow the cover, isn't it? So I may do it. I may do it.
Yeah, I would encourage you to. That'd be fantastic. Bill, what are your thoughts on that? You think you should follow through with that?
Well, I definitely, and handing out the car. Having done litigation work for 30 years, that was a good advice from your attorney to give, you know, to give you his card to say I'm not going to talk to you and to talk to my attorney. But I think it'd be nothing ventured, nothing gained. So you know, I think it'd be a great idea to do that.
It sounds exciting as I'll get it. Will you keep us posted if you follow through with that? I'd love to see the feedback from that. That'd be fabulous.
I've got one other question for you, Art. And Brent knows that I've asked this as some other guests. Did you ever do a Freedom of Information Act request from the government with regards to anything that might have been prepared memo-wise from the government regarding this crash? Have you ever gone that route?
No, I haven't. My good friend Stanton Friedman, by the way, is recovering from a mild heart attack. For anybody out there would want to send some good thoughts his way, about two and a half weeks ago. He's up in
Fredericton.
I can't think of the Canadian name. Is there who Maine? In any case, he had spent a lot of time sending for things and holding it up in front of the camera in little big black holes, and you know, in the material that they had set for it. I'm not patient enough to wait for the government to send me a bunch of stuff with everything crossed out. I don't think they had. I think this may have been, if not the first, one of the first UFO crashes. It was found about 4 days before Roswell wreckage was found. Now they could have collided also. It could have been. And by the way, I have a friend doing some work over there in the Roswell area, and they also found foil. Isn't that interesting? So small pieces, but they found some. So I haven't gone that route, and I was finding material. I didn't know what to do with it myself. I had found a way to get money to get it analyzed, and I just took off. Most of the stuff was done by, until we got a backer come in around 2011, we footed the bill for the analysis of everything up to that point. It was probably around about $8,000. So we had our hands full of writing for blank paper with stuff blacked out. Wasn't high on my priority list.
Well, I will tell you this, that I and Brent knows this. I have a dear friend who's a researcher with regards to the Kennedy assassination, who has submitted a number of different freedom of information requests to the government, and he has gotten back some gems. And you know, it takes 30 minutes to do this, to send it out to the appropriate agencies. But you may be very surprised at a response that you might get, and it doesn't take any time at all. So I throw that out at you, because, as I said, you might get a gem back that you know nothing about. So even if something's redacted, you know that it popped up on the radar screen of the government, just like Lieutenant Reed, the colonel at the Pentagon, told him to go talk to Barney. Well, how the heck did that colonel know that Barney existed? So I can guarantee you that there is some memo, some documents floating around somewhere that just might get picked up. So I just throw that out for whatever it's worth.
Well, it certainly is an avenue to pursue, that's for sure. We also had, at Roswell, there wasn't any wreckage for civilians to look into. And it's, we're absolutely sure it happened at Roswell. But not until a friend of mine a year or two ago found a little piece of the foil out of the crash site, the debris peel, they called it. And it matched ours, by the way, some of our foil. Which tells us that the technology probably was the same, and not the same craft. Originally, the Roswell people were threatened by the bodies on the plane to San Augustine, thinking that maybe the Roswell craft had hit down over on the Foster Ranch, and then gone all the way over to the plane to San Augustine, and then crashed. And things kind of polarized around Roswell after they first started using it as a tourist coming and the motels and everything. It got to be all too very commercial, very, very commercial. I was out there digging on the plane to San Augustine, and they have their 40th renewal in 1997, sorry. And I didn't want to even be involved in it. I'm not into the hype kind of thing, and I'm not playing politics, and I've got material I'm digging up I can't figure out what to do with. So I pretty well stayed over there in that area. As long as I was finding material, there's no reason to leave to go anywhere else.
Let's go in a different direction now, or actually the same direction. I wanted to talk about Eisenhower, who was spotted at Holloman Air Force Base February 9th, 1955, because I think this is very important to the narrative of this whole thing we're discussing tonight. And that,
well,
is,
anybody who wants to read about that, I have it on my website. That's www.ufocrashbook.com. So they can order the book there if they want to. But we have one called Eisenhower and Holloman, and here's how it evolved. We had heard about a gentleman from the Kansas City area, again, where we used to live. He sent a letter to a UFO early UFO mid-90s talk show host, and had gotten on and had met some of the had talked to one or two of the early UFO writers, Linda Moulton Howe, and some other people. But he was surprised that nothing was ever done with his letter. And he said that he was stationed at Holloman Air Force Base in 1955. Now, he was only there 6 months, something like October to March, something like that. And he said about a month before he left, he had heard that Eisenhower was coming to Holloman, and that he wanted to stand in a parade. Now, the parade for the civilians out there is a red carpet with the shiny shoes and the flags and a welcoming committee and all that, and that's what the president usually has when he goes somewhere. And he was asked if he wanted to be part of that. He says, well, I don't think so. He said, I'll just be on duty. Well, that's exactly where he was on duty when everything was happening. they canceled the parade. They didn't have it at all. But anyhow, he said he'd seen the president's plane, and there was only one like it at the time, the Lockheed four-engine Constellation. And they were three models at that time. I think the Eisenhower at that time was in with Constellation 2. He said earlier one, the Colt 1, and a Columbine. And Columbine is a state flower of Colorado. And it's called, so it was, Mamie was from Denver, so they called it the Columbine 1, 2, and 3 in about 7 years. In any case, he saw the plane taking off, and he'd heard Eisenhower was there that day on the base. But his friend, who was coming in from a little town of Alamogordo, where he lived, saw a UFO hovering over the flight line at Holloman. Well, it was a novelty, all right. They didn't hear anything or see anything. There's this big silver disc hovering. And so he goes into the base hospital. This fellow was a hospital corpsman, quite a credible man. And so have you seen they didn't call them UFOs those days. That term wasn't coined. I don't think till about 3 or 4 years later. It's the disc out here floating over the hangar. He said, no, but he said, I got to ask permission to go out there. Well, they had sent, when Eisenhower was supposed to visit the base, they had told everybody there's about 8,000 civilians there. They had big repair shops and things there, and two or three military units. Just business as usual. Don't do anything different. See, smile and go on with your work, you know. So they had learned to low-key Eisenhower's visit for whatever reason. We know now, but we didn't know at the time why they didn't want to make more of him coming. So in any case, he asked permission to go out and see this craft hovering over the hangars. And he had asked permission of the head nurse. He was on duty at the dispensary there. And they said, no, we'd rather you wouldn't. And then he saw them out there looking at something. In any case, his friend had seen it coming in. And then he kept getting reports during the day. Went for coffee about 10:45 and heard the two officers talking. One of them was officer of the day. And since it landed over there on the active runway, and we kept the runway active, which means no one uses it, and it's only one long runway at Holloman, there's a shorter one, and there's kind of a bar of an A in the middle between them, and that's where the tower is. And then he heard two other people talking, and he said, well, he got out of it. Plane. They didn't call Air Force One those days. That wasn't coined until Kennedy's administration, I think, 5 years later. But he got out of the plane and walked towards this disc on the ground. And we didn't thought it was some German thing or something. You know, they weren't too far away, the German scientists, that went 100 miles. They had no idea that it was extraterrestrial. And what we think it was. And he went inside, shook hands with somebody, and the little ramp came down, and then 40 minutes later, he came out. Well, we found the Air Force One personnel. We talked to four of them, and one of them served Roosevelt, Truman, and Eisenhower, and said, told another guy that they were, Eisenhower was hunting in Georgia and had stuck away from this hunting trip, but there was a plane load of press there at the time. And Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles, who was our Secretary of State at the time, had warned Red China that if they invaded Formosa, they'd be in a nuclear war. Well, the whole international press decided that it could be a nuclear war. They want to be near where Eisenhower is. So they chartered a plane to go with him. So they were holed up at the Scott Hotel, drinking the bar dry there. And Eisenhower was down this is Thomasville, Georgia. Eisenhower was down at a plantation called Milestone that was run by owned by Humphrey, who was the Secretary of the Treasury. He'd appointed him. So he had complete privacy there and 4 or 5 exits. So the press never got in there to see him. And he went down for bird hunting, and they heard a few shots, and then they said the next morning, the press secretary in Hagerty said, well, Eisenhower got the sniffles, and he's going to be inside for a few days.
Got this.
And he's playing Scrabble with Mamie in the fireplace and so forth. And, yeah, sure, you know. And it turns out we think he had the opportunity to go to Holloman, a 500-mile trip. Plane could go 300 miles an hour, and it was based up at Spence Air Force Base north of Thomasville. That's where they flew in, and they brought 13 Secret Service agents and never traveled with more than 4 or 5. And this one Air Force guy told me, he said, except one time he went out west somewhere. I said, that's got to be it. So he left 4 or 5 secret service agents to go in and out of the gate so the press wouldn't be alarmed. Took some with him and apparently went to Holloman and went aboard a UFO. Now that's the story. My friend saw the plane, did not see the UFO, didn't see like going into it, but did see the plane leaving about 5 that afternoon. Well, we found 2 witnesses. One of them called me as a result of an article I had in the UFO magazine. And she said, my father was an electrician there, and he tells a story about the day he became a fireman. And I said, fireman? She said, he was up on a pole, and apparently it was the same UFO that the one guy saw hanging down by the hangars. That UFO was probably riding shotgun for the other one, to protect the other one, if there was another one out in front of Ike's plane. There was one, up in the air looking around. And he said, I heard a lot of commotion, and he was up on the pole with his spikes. And he was an electrician, a lineman. And he said, I heard the truck start up. People started running, and I'm up on the pole. What's going on here? Turn around. He said, there's this pie tin thing about 100, 150 feet away from me coming my way. And that's the saucer that we talked about, a little sensor and thankful it was. And he said, I threw that strap out, which is how they do that here in the Northwest, I'm sure in Canada, that they can get down on those spikes real quick.
No kidding.
By throwing the strap out and just kind of falling down the tree, you know.
Sure.
And they nicknamed the fireman, got down so fast. And they all went scurrying various places, and they finally got into a hangar, and they looked out, and the craft was just wobbling, and finally just slowly went away. And so this gal had a letter from her father written about 2 months before he died, and he said, well, we've told this story so many times that when Dad became a fireman, we'd like him to write it down, you know. Sometimes we think to ask older people to do that. Like coming down is important. And so she read me part of a letter that I used at a conference up at Gaithersburg in 2009 about that incident, him being on the pole when the UFO was 150 feet away. So the other witness, we ran down in Oakland, California. We knew a brother of his was involved in some of our research, and she said, well, I had a brother down there that said he saw something at the Holloman, and found out they were all there at the same time. And he was flying in from Indiana with freight to Holloman, and he landed there on about the 10th or 11th. And they were going to go out the next morning. Well, they couldn't go out because the main runway was blocked with the Eisenhower plane for that day. still got towed away. And they kept the runway closed for the entire day Ike was there until he left later that afternoon about 5:30. So he remembers then, he said, well, we were at the mess hall and trying to figure out what to do with our time, and the officer came by and said, do you want to see hear the president speak? Well, they'd seen this big plane land in the morning, but it'd gotten hidden behind some hangars. They didn't know that that the president was there. They heard he was coming. They assumed it might have been, but they didn't know he was specifically there. So they said, sure, yeah. So they went down to this theater place. I think it was a hangar. And they wouldn't let him in. They didn't have the right ID. Well, the officer was there and said, well, I think he's going to talk again over at the base theater, and I'll see if he can get you in there. So he heard him talk and saw him there, and it was kind of a funny talk. Keep up the good work, fellas. We know how important it is. This was about the second year after the end of the Korean War. And we were just about ready to go. It was like nuclear war with Russia. Malenkov had been deposed, and the Soviet Union was looking for a new leader. Khrushchev hadn't managed to rise up yet. And that's why all the press were so concerned about being with Eisenhower.
Yeah, United Nations. Isn't that funny? The Soviet Union is what I meant to say, folks. Had just elected, if you will, quote-unquote, in a communist country, or I should say just installed a fellow by the name of Marshall Buchanan. And he was a big, big-time, very aggressive war general for the Second World War. And there was a lot of fear that he was going to be so aggressive and take over lands, kind of like what Putin just did within the Ukraine, but escalate that even further. Sorry to interrupt you, my friend. I just wanted to give
it No, that's all right. After about 3 days, Eisenhower came out of his scramble game, and then the press were, apparently they had been out the night before, and most of them had Bloody Mary for breakfast, so they weren't doing too well. But he said, well, you guys are looking kind of sad this morning. He said, really, you've had the week we've had, you'd be sad too. In any case, he was out then and was seen again, and the next day he flew back to Washington, and they flew back with him. And Humphrey had got an idea to get all of the people away from any of the highways or the airport. He threw a big party with free booze for the reporters. Well, that's pretty hard to pass up. And they had invited some hostesses. They'd gotten about four or five or six divorcees from the Avron Country Club, and who had renowned. And they told every other divorcee in town, so we had these 30 guys from the different press, including all over the country, and in some foreign countries, being entertained by about 15 or 20 hostesses in strapless gowns. So it must have been an interesting evening. I think they were well distracted.
That's a very kind way to put it. Yes, absolutely. Any idea?
So that's the story of Eisenhower and Holloman. Well, we think he had the opportunity to go, and he could have gone, and his plane was seen there, and one or two other people, one guy saw him. He's since passed away. Another fellow had a record for father. And we spoke on that. It had nothing to do with our place. That was kind of interim. After the 2005 or so, we were kind of had found about everything we were going to at this one part of the site. So this came up, and we decided to kind of follow it through. And it was a very interesting project.
Any speculation as to what the context of that conversation may have been inside that craft between President Eisenhower and whoever he was meeting with?
I've talked to several people about it, and the book I want to recommend is Tim Good's Alien, Earth and Alien Enterprise. And Tim took my story just about the way I told it to you and put it in one of his chapters in that book. And he's an internationally known author. And so some of the people that I've talked to think, well, at 40 minutes, you wouldn't have time to really meet somebody or have a cup of whatever. And it might have been just checking somebody out, meeting somebody for the first time. It could be, they were very, very interested in non-nuclear proliferation, right, problems with Russia. And I think they were for a generation until we started, cutting back.
Yeah, and I think with
I think they thought it might endanger them because we were on the verge of space travel, and here we had this terrible weapon that we weren't supposed to have for many years, and so it probably made them nervous. So that was their first concern with us, I think, was the world has got to get some of this nuclear stuff out of the way, and they've since been seen over many nuclear facilities, and even to this day, they're seen.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense to me. Do you think the tradition is carried on? Do you think every president or world leader has been privy? Do you think they've contacted the Russians? Speculations.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think they wouldn't just pick us. If you were going to have two potential warring powers, and you thought you could do something to keep them from going to war, and I don't think they wanted nuclear bombs exploded mainly. You would find a way to get a hold of the other people, the other side. And we found many, many people from Russia, and particularly in the 80s, who came out after the Berlin Wall went down in the 1990s, and said that they'd had lots of contact with UFOs.
Wow.
And they don't have any stories of landings and contact with people, but there was a gentleman up in the northern part of the country in Maine who was a state legislator. His name escaped me right now, but some of the listeners out there know who he is. Saw a letter that was a briefing letter for Eisenhower, talking about that he had met with several alien races representatives.
More than one, more than just Grayson. Wow.
Yeah, I think they got to something like a three of them. And some of the people, he had a conversation a time up in 1954 up in an Edwards Air Force Base, and when he was supposed to go to a dentist, and they thought he'd better go off and see some aliens. But, I mean, some of the people with the wild ideas had been signing a treaty and trading abductees for technology, and I mean, it's just gone, information just gone blockers.
But it would make sense, though, if there was extraterrestrials out there, that they would contact the leader of the free world, without question, and let's face it, that's the president of the United
States. I think it makes sense, too.
Yeah. I think absolutely it does. Folks, great show tonight. Absolutely fabulous. Finding the UFO Crash at St. Augustine. My guest tonight, Art Campbell, wrote the book, www.nightfrightshow.com. Just click on tonight's guest book cover. That'll take you right to a place where you can order the book from the comfort of your own home, as I say. And I've got to plug my own book at the same time one more time. I'm supposed to do it three times, but this will be the second and last one. JFK Assassination, From the Oval Office to Dealey Plaza, interviews with witnesses and specialists, including the last interview with Ted Sorensen, JFK's friend and speechwriter, who I spent an afternoon with. I interviewed him several times for the radio, and I spent an afternoon with him in his Manhattan apartment, and he was ready to unload. I don't know if it was premonition on his part, but I think he knew it was going to be his last interview, as corny and as cliche as that sounds. And indeed, he did unload that day about the assassination and many other things, including their fear, the Kennedy administration's fear of military coup, especially during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And thank goodness that never came to pass. Anyways, you can get that book at www.nightfrightshow.com. The book cover's there, folks. You can order it through Amazon as well. No problems there. Barnes & Noble apparently is carrying it as well, and I'm hoping to do a book tour very shortly. Let's go back to Art, who's the focus of our show tonight. Art, you know, it's been how many years since, I don't know, it's going on, what, it's well over 50 years, 60 years since the crash took place in 1947. Do you think we're going to get disclosure anytime soon?
I think it's crept up on us, Brent.
Hmm.
When I was speaking in the Kansas City area, I was a college student in those days, in the late 50s, I don't think thought 4 or 5% of the audience would even think there was life on other planets. Now the latest survey I hear is something like 75 or 80% of the people think there's life on other planets, and many of those think we're being visited. I don't think a big disclosure is going to be necessary. I think people are going to know that it's true, and somebody might confirm it. It doesn't have to be a high politician, you know. It could be a low-level person. So it wouldn't have to be the president. That'd be a kiss of death. But for a politician, because of you have people that would be turned off with the religious angle of things. And that would be very threatening. But you could have a low-level bureaucrat delegated to make an announcement, and it would probably just be well taken. The Catholic Church has started already conditioning their people with announcements concerning extraterrestrial life. And there's a Father Funes, I don't know whether I've butchered the name or not, but F-U-N-E-S, who's a Vatican astronomer, and has made some very interesting statements about extraterrestrials and UFOs.
Yeah, he should.
You could find quite a bit of material on the internet.
Yeah. Essentially, he says that, quote unquote, and I'm going to have to paraphrase it. Essentially, he says that if there are extraterrestrials out there, they'll be our brothers as well. That there's one God for the whole universe, and for somebody from the Vatican to come out and say something of that magnitude, I think we should all be aware of that. Bill has another question for us. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, it was just an insight with regards to this. You know, people think that, you know, the United States is the end all of saying, you know, what's out there and what's not out there. You've got the British government that came out with all of their divulged all of their files. I forget the gentleman's name that ran the division for the British government with regards to UFOs, and he comes out and says, they're there. You have the Belgian government that comes out and says, they're there. So for people to think, well, you got to have confirmation from the government, from the United States government, it's not rational thinking. You've got other governments that's come forward, and the Mexican government. You've got all these governments that come forward, high-ranking officials that say, these, you know, aliens are here, UFOs are here, we've been visited, and just because the United States isn't forthcoming, you know, so what? Other governments have. So are other governments lying, you know, to everybody? No, I don't think so. So it infuriates me, because we're not, the U.S. government is the end all to say what's happened to this world when it comes to visitation from, you know, from other dimensions.
Solid point, Bill, and I can guarantee you that there are aliens in Canada. They all congregate in a place we call Ottawa. They go by another name here. We call them politicians.
And do they visit you every
night? We have a few of those in the States, too.
Sometimes most Canadians just shake their heads in puzzlement. What are they doing now? And this is what our elected officials are doing for us.
Well, you know, Brett, you've had on, I believe, one of the top officials in the Canadian government before. I forget what the gentleman's name was. He was high in the government. Who says, this is a reality, okay? We don't need confirmation from the United States government that this is a reality. And a lot of people in the States think that, you know, because it's not confirmed by whomever's in power, Obama, whomever, Clinton, whomever, that it doesn't exist. It doesn't ring with clarity, because other people in other countries are just as smart, are just as forthcoming. And so it's just one of those things. It's just like, you know, come on.
We have a political system that's different than any others in the world. And we have probably a more diverse group of people that are populate our country. And they talk to us about being a great melting pot. Well, most of them melted, some of them didn't. So we have a lot of very strong, sometimes religious, sometimes ethnic, people. And they don't all think a lot alike. And I think the government has been fairly smart in trying to keep this down, because our people might react differently than they did in England or in a totalitarian place like Russia, or certainly Belgium is a democracy. But I have a feeling that they are thinking of the people, and then some of the top people are thinking of their, how they're going to look if they turn out to be liars. And I just think it just kind of perpetuates itself. So just a little fear builds into a big fear.
Do you guys think that it would just upset the whole apple cart and our way of, I won't say the way of life, but the industrial, the way we do business, the dollar, for example, the whole system would just crash because it would be meaningless?
Brett, I just got to interject, and I've got to disagree with Art on this. People are smart, okay? The American people are smart. And they want to be told the truth. I don't think that there's going to be riots in the street or people are going to go jumping off buildings if President Obama came out, in a day or two and said, we've been visited. It's not going to happen. People are rational thinking individuals. It certainly hasn't happened in Britain. Certainly hasn't happened in Belgium. Why do you think it's going to happen in the United States? I don't agree with that kind of thought. People want to be told the truth. And as you said, the survey, 75% of the people think that it's, that we've been visited or that there are, other people in the universe. Well, why do you think that if some kind of clarification came out that all of a sudden those 75% or the other 25% are going to start jumping off buildings? I don't agree with that. I think that if it came out, everyone would go, okay, that's fine. Let's get on with business.
I have a disclosure tape by Ed Mitchell, the astronaut.
Oh, sure.
And yeah. He's on a program.
You can mention the name of the program. That's fine.
Kerrang! Is a rock station in England.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy he's telling the guy that there's aliens out there and UFOs. And this guy says, what, where are you going? No, this is too much to take on. Here's a typical guy probably in the entertainment industry. He's the manager of a station, and it's a rock radio station. And it goes about 10 minutes, and I picked it up on the Internet, and I got permission from Ed Mitchell to make a video of it. And I told him to never give it away or sell it. I just wanted to use it for my UFO talk, so I'll be talking, showing it in the Kansas City and the Paracon conference there on the 1st of August. But it's only 10 minutes, so it'll kind of give you an idea. He felt more free to talk to the British audience than he would the U.S. audience. And I think that tells us something. I don't know why he seems to be more concerned about wanting to be one of the regular astronauts, but I think he can't help himself. So who knows? I think there are lots of reasons that we don't know why we aren't being told. I can guess with you, and you guys can guess other things. But
do you think it's because of the mainstream press? Because I noticed even with my book, here I've got Ted Sorensen virtually confirming conspiracy, and I can't get the time of day from mainstream press. Do you think it has something to do with that?
I have a kind of fear. How the mainstream press has handled it in the towns I've been in is they'll publish a local sighting.
Yeah.
But it won't go to the next town. I don't think it's a plot. I think it's just the way the news is. I wouldn't be too interested in somebody sighting in Roseburg, 100 miles north of me. But a town 5 miles south, I would be interested. So I think that the news is self policing. It stays kind of where it was created for the people who think it's news. And I'm not sure that there's a big plot that anybody who comes out and says that the UFOs are there or whatever is going to be ostracized and hunted down and That was mentioned, by the way. Ed Mitchell said that one time there were people disappearing as a result of such investigations, but they're not doing it anymore, apparently.
That's a healthy sign. I just think we're edging towards complete disclosure worldwide, and I'm kind of on Bill's side with this one. I think people are smart enough and hip enough now to realize perhaps not all that we've been fed over the years is the gospel, if you will. Bill, did you have another question?
Well, I just wanted to thank you again for responding to my email. You're an officer and a gentleman, and it's been a pleasure listening to you, and I've listened to a number of your videos. I got enthralled on this when you were on the UFO Hunters. I'm sure that was probably something fun to do with Bill Burris. Is that right, Brent?
Bill Burns, B-I-R-N-E-S.
B-I-R-N-S.
It's UFO Hunters. The Real Roswell is the name of the program, of all things. And where they came out to the site, and I showed them this artifact that we think was a artificial body organ, and they took it to a laboratory, part of the UFO Hunters show. It was a lot of fun.
But anyway, I just wanted to thank you for your kindness and consideration, and it's been a real pleasure talking with you tonight.
Well, I will be glad to answer anybody who writes or emails. It's no problem at all. I'm retired, and I'd like to talk about it.
Sure, folks, and, that information will be on the www.nightfrightshow.com website. The book we've been talking about tonight is called Finding the UFO Crash at San Augustine. Our guest tonight is Art Campbell, and I want to thank Bill for recommending Art Campbell to me to get on the show because I have thoroughly enjoyed it. It has been fantastic. Bill, thank you for joining us with great questions, too. Art, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. You are indeed an officer and a gentleman, and thank you for your service. By the way, folks, Art served over in Korea, and for that, we all owe him a debt of gratitude without question. I'd also like to find out more about your Western books that you've written, perhaps for another show. So I will contact you about those as well, because that's something that's always intrigued me as well, is the history of the American West. It's fascinating, especially with indigenous folks. Folks, you're listening to Night Fright. I'm your host, Brent Holland. What's next for you, my friend? You said before that you don't want to go back, that you've had enough. But if somebody came up to you with, indeed, a Jeep or a Bronco or something, would you go?
Well, we'll have to play that by ear. I haven't got any offers right now, but it's
I own a white Bronco, so I may be sending an invitation.
There you go, guys, and you can go fishing. At the same time.
Well, it's been a real pleasure for me, too.
I just want to thank Art once again. And, folks, by the way, there's been a wealth of information on the UFOs. Some of the people we've talked about tonight, Stan Friedman, Bill Burns, of course. You're going to find those shows in our archives at the www.nightfrightshow.com. website, and as always, the shows are free to download. Make a donation if you're so inclined. That would certainly help things out. I just want to thank everybody for sending their emails in and making the show such a success. I am overwhelmed by the kindness and generosity of the fans that are out there. It is a true pleasure doing the show.